not on the same page here, because take a look to the reaction of Donald Trump right after the aggression, the U.S. aggression on the Iranian nuclear reactors.
Mm-hmm.
He was portraying this aggression as if it was the first and the last attack on Iranian facilities that threaten the Zionist entity. He was, it's like he was telling the Israelis that I have done it for you, and it's going to be this time and
one
no
time
more.
Shot.
One time shot. Of course, the Israelis are not satisfied with the outcomes of the aggression, the 12 days aggression on Iran.
And that's why they constantly speak about yes. possible attacks and possible war.
Exactly. When they talk about the cards, they had cards, tough cards. They confess that it took them years to build on those strong cards, and they used them. And they failed, actually, to reach their goal. Their ultimate goal was to oust the regime.
Mm-hmm.
The regime would fall inside Iran.
Yes.
And that's why they expressed it openly during the first 3 or 4 days of the aggression. Mm-hmm. I think Trump now is more interested to succeed in Gaza, because it's his reputation, his image that is at stake. Because he personally took it with his chest that he is going to succeed in Gaza. He's going to prevent the reasons that would put them again into a continuous war, a wide-scale war, regional war that has no end.
And presented himself as a peacemaker.
That's why he is interested now in satisfying the demands made by his popular base, MAGA. They are pressing Trump that he has to end this.
Yes, and even his national security, of course, does not show any desire for war in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. However, here the major question concerning this report, if Israel has a different eye on what's happening inside Iran, will the Americans still refuse to indulge in any war, as long as you're saying that Trump is somewhere else?
I think that the Americans now, they are in charge of everything that has to deal with aggressions, whether in Gaza, whether in Lebanon, whether in Syria, and of course in Iran.
Yes.
We are witnessing now how the Americans are, managing all the activities now taking place in the region. And mm-hmm. I believe personally that the Americans have been doing this since 2 years. But now, as they succeeded in forcing Benjamin Netanyahu to end, to reach a ceasefire in Gaza, they want to prevent any reasons that would make Benjamin Netanyahu come again and say we need to go again in Lebanon or in Gaza or whether in Iran. That's why I think
yes.
Americans are keen now to solve some issues regarding the, making this buffer zones mm-hmm. around the Zionist entity, to tell the Zionists that we ensured...
You are protected and no need to launch more wars.
We ensured your security. Okay. You have no excuses anymore for more wars.
Okay. In the same context, one Israeli commentator said that Iran has come to possess major military and missile capabilities that threaten the Israeli entity, and that war against it is the way to prevent this threat. Isn't it a sign that Israel's previous war on Iran was not a success, when the assessment here, according to this report, that if another war to be launched, then we can analyze that Iran is ready for this war? That means the first round of war was not successful. However, they were bragging that it was.
Well, first of all, we have to take into consideration that the Israel lobby in the United States is putting pressure on the U.S. administration to adopt the vision that the job is not finished, that we have to go for a second stage of war against Iran. And they are claiming that Iran is possessing more armaments and missiles capabilities, and they are on the verge of waging is the second stage. I think this is nonsense, because Iran has made it clearly that they are on the defense side.
Yes.
Situation here. They are defending their soils, their sovereignty, and at the same time, they are still committed in supporting resistance movements in the region. The Trump administration here is listening to two sides, the neocons and the MAGA. The MAGA is telling Trump that what has been done is more than sufficient. You cannot go into war again with Iran. We have more important things to do,
okay,
more priorities for our own national security. In another war in Iran, it's going to be a MIGA, make Israel great again. They are pressuring Trump that you cannot go into another war because it's not in the interest of our own national security.
Mm-hmm.
The neocons and the Likudists, they are trying to tell Trump that
even Trump's advisors?
Yes, exactly, because his advisors are split.
Yes.
He has Marco Rubio, he has Mike Waltz, he has another second or third class officials in his administration. They are adopting the vision of Benjamin Netanyahu that we have to go again into war. But the MAGA officials, and led by J.D. Vance, they are telling Trump openly that we cannot do this anymore because we have our own national security strategy. We have our own priorities because Benjamin Netanyahu wants continuous, endless wars. We cannot follow him on everything. We have followed him during last June. We are not willing to do this again.
Okay, who would he listen to?
I think Trump made some signs that he is now willing to listen to
MAGA.
What MAGA are telling him, because we are now into primaries, preparing for the midterms in less than a year. So he has to...
In
Venezuela, a regime change in Venezuela might be easier. We have to make it clear that MAGA, they are not against the war for, moral reasons.
Yes.
They are against the war for economic reasons.
You're saying they have more important files on their agenda.
Yes, and if there is something in front of them and they assess that they can win without any costs, they can go for it.
Mm-hmm.
They would go for it, as what is portrayed with Venezuela. But with Iran, they know that there would be an aftermath that would hurt their national interests in the region. They know it's not going to be a short war if they listen to Benjamin Netanyahu, because Benjamin Netanyahu wants an all-out war.
Okay.
It's going to be a long war. That's why they don't want it.
Yes.
For economic reasons.
Moving to the ongoing threats against Lebanon, where Israeli commentators underscored the necessity of disarming Hezbollah, even if this requires operations against the Lebanese army. What do you make out of what was said targeting the Lebanese army?
Well, this reflects how certain elements in the Israeli government and in the military establishment, they are still daydreaming about another invasion of Lebanon. They are not satisfied. They want more. And we know that when, in the case of Lebanon, the more the Lebanese government is expressing its willingness to give more to the Americans and the Israelis at the end.
Concerning negotiations.
Yes, the more the Israelis are going to be more demanding. That's the situation here, because they are not satisfied with the Lebanese army stance here. And we know that the Likudist Israel lobby in Washington, they presented through some congressmen a repeal of the National Defense Authorization Act,
mm-hmm,
2026. There is a section that states openly that the aid given by the U.S. to the Lebanese army is going to be in the face of a some kind of mechanism to assess whether the Lebanese army did something with regards to the disarmament of Hezbollah or not. If they assess that the Lebanese army didn't do this, they are going to stop the aid to the Lebanese army. This is a precedent about what the Israelis are planning for Lebanon. They don't care. I think they are splitting the negotiations path and the aggression, their intentions toward Lebanon. But I still assess my personal opinion that the Americans are not going to let the Israelis wage a new expanded war against Lebanon that includes incursions inside Lebanon to maximize the areas that they occupy in South Lebanon. Up to now, the stance, the official stance of the Lebanese government as well as the resistance, they are openly saying that we have done what is required from our side. There are no resistance actions to the southern part of the Litani River. That's why the Israelis cannot claim that we have not committed to the ceasefire agreement.
Okay.
We are committed to the ceasefire agreement. That's why we listened from Tom Barwak, the U.S. envoy to the region, that we may take into consideration that disarming Hezbollah is going to be impossible.
Okay.
That's why they are assessing another way. They are talking about freezing the weapons,
yes,
the heavy artillery with the resistance.
Okay. 1 year after the fall of Assad's regime in Syria and the rise of al-Julani to power there, Israeli territorial incursions territory continues to escalate, with Hebrew media pointing to real risks threatening al-Julani and his regime. Do you think that these comments are related to the recent events in Beijing?
I think that the Israelis are still assessing, pushing Syria into partitioning. They have been talking about assassinating, a possible plan to assassinate al-Julani. They are still seriously assessing that their interest is in a partitioned Syria.
Okay.
That's why when they talk about the stability in Syria, we all know there is no stability in Syria.
Yes.
It's like an excuse for what they are going to do in the southern part of Syria, exactly.
Okay, Mr. Ali Murad, writer and political researcher. Unfortunately, our time is up. Thank you very much for joining us in today's episode.
The world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of IRIB English Radio, Salamun Alaikum. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
السلام عليكم جميعا ورحمة الله وبركاته. I begin in the name of Allah, the most kind, the most merciful. It's due to that kindness and mercy that we have these opportunities where we gather in remembrance and glorification of Him, Tabaraka wa Ta'ala. We then send our congratulatory messages to our 12th and living Imam Al-Hujja, Ajjalallahu Ta'ala, Farajahu Sharif, and to each and every one of you as we gather on this beautiful night to celebrate the birth anniversary of Our Lady of Light, the daughter of our beloved Prophet, Fatima al-Zahra, alayhim afdalu salatu wa salam. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad wa ajil farajahum. We pray to Allah Azza wa Jal that He bless us with a higher ma'rifa and knowledge of the Lady of Light in our lives, and that we receive her shafa'at in the hereafter. Before I begin, you know, it's nice to see that alhamdulillah our community is growing in different ways. And so now you see Islamic schools and the importance of Islamic schools being brought to the front of our reminders and of reality. And I hope inshallah we support such initiatives inshallah, because this is how our future generations will prosper with true faith inshallah. The title of Siddiqa is very important. It's a title that we are told is given to her by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Our sixth Imam As-Sadiq, alayhi afdalu salatu wa salam. Ma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Is reported to have said, li Fatimata alayha salam tis'atu asma indallah. That Fatima alayha salam has 9 names that have been given to her by Allah, that Allah recognizes her with these 9 names. What are they? Fatima, was-Siddiqa, wal-Mubaraka, the one who is blessed, wat-Tahira, the one who is clean or pure, Zakiya, there's an inner purity, wal-Radiya, and Mardiya, the one who is content, and the one whom God is content with, wal-Muhaddatha, the one who is spoken to by angels, was Zahra, yeah, the one who is illuminated. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. So one of the titles that she's been given is the title of Siddiqa. Yeah? And the title of Siddiqa, the one who is, you know, it's described in English as the one who is voracious. Right? Voracious really means the one who is internally and externally truthful, like completely truthful. You will never find hints of falsehood within that person. You will never find any traces of that which is inconsistent from the truth within that person. That's a person who attains the status of being what's known as a Siddiq or a Siddiqa. And this is a title that has a lot of profound meaning associated to it, right? Again, we find a hadith that's reported by our sixth Imam alayhi salam, where he was asked by another person by the name of Abi Abdullah, and he says to him, Man ghasala Fatima, that who gave ghusl to the body of Fatima? To which he replied back, he said, Daka Amirul Mu'mineen. He said, Amirul Mu'mineen gave ghusl to Fatima. And he was caught off guard, yeah, because we generally don't have men giving ghusl to women, right? And then Imam alayhi salam says to him, La tadiqanna, do not be surprised at this. He says, do not be shocked at this. Fa innaha siddiqa, wa lam yakun yaghsiluha illa siddiqun. Subhanallah. Yeah? He says, she was a siddiqa, and none can give ghusl to a siddiqa except for a siddiq. Yeah? Ya Ali. And this is what we understand from this hadith, right? That to be a Siddiq or a Siddiqa is in a status of its own, right? And it is a status that, of course, we can strive towards. But when a person reaches that status, only those who have reached a similar status can understand that person. Only one who has reached a similar status, not that status, because there are statuses amongst the statuses, right? But only one who has attained proximity to that status can be considered to be with such people. And our goal in life is to be with Muhammad and Ali Muhammad. Yeah? Salat ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad. That's the goal, right? Like with that, we can never lose focus of what the goal is. This is why we recite in ziyarat, Allahumma ja'alna ma'ahum fi dunya wal akhirah. Allah, make us be amongst them. We want to be with them. Yeah, so it's not something that's out of the realm of possibility. You know, sometimes people say they are there, we can't touch them. Yes, they are there. We can't reach that status 100%. But man, we can strive to be in the same ballpark as them. Yeah, we can strive to be in the same hall as them. We can strive to be in the same Jannah as them, right? But they are a status of their own. There's no denying this whatsoever. But we wouldn't be taught to ask for this dua, where we say, Allahumma ja'alna ma'ahum fi dunya wal akhirah. Place us amongst them in dunya and akhirah, unless it was possible to be in that same Jannah as them, right? And so the goal is to be with them, but we can't be with them unless we begin to embody them. We can't be with them until I myself have some siddiq, some truthfulness in me, because they are siddiq and siddiqa. How then can I be with them if I'm not a sadiq or a sadiqa? And so the question is that how do we be this? And this is, Allah encourages us to strive for this. The verse we recited in the khutbah from Surah Tawbah, verse 119, Allah Azza wa Jal says, Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ittaqullah. Be conscious of Allah. Be mindful of Allah. Wa kunu ma'as sadiqeen. And be amongst the truthful. Right? Allah is prompting us to strive in our lives to be amongst those who are truthful in everything we do. And so the question again comes is, how do we become truthful? How do we reach this status? These verbs or these words that we said, that she has reached the status of being a siddiqa, he had reached the status of being a siddiq. It comes from the root word of sidq. Yes, sad dal qaf. A person who is truthful is a sadiq, we said. A person, a lady who is truthful is known as a sadiqa. But then there is another level higher than that, where you now have a shadda on that dal. Yeah, where now you're not a sadiq, but you are a siddiq. You're not a sadiqa, but you are a siddiqa. And so consider these like two levels, right? The first level is that a person strives in their lives to become a sadiq or a sadiqa. The second level is a person then strives and attains such a status where they graduate to now become a siddiq or a siddiqa. The aim should be at the higher level, but I can't get to that higher level without going through the levels that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has placed amongst us. So how do we then first and foremost start off to where at least I can be called a sadiq? Or I can be called a sadiqa, right? This is, as we said, it means to be truthful. This truthfulness is not just a truthfulness in speech. Yeah, it starts off with that, right? Because that's the most common attribution of truthfulness there is. Is this person, can I believe them or not, right? And this is why, you know, sometimes like we're told not to joke around too much, yeah? Joke, but not joke around too much, yeah? Make people laugh, but not to that extent where now anytime you say something, you're like, bro, I don't know if it was true or not. Yeah, it's funny, but I don't know if it was true or not. You don't want that reputation where now people genuinely can't tell whether you were being truthful or not, because that's how important truthfulness is to this picture, right? And so it starts off with speech, but then it continues where truthfulness now manifests itself in my belief. It manifests itself in my actions. It manifests itself in my intentions, it manifests itself in my behavior.
The mother of Aima, Ya Fatima, the mother of Aima, Ya Fatima, you are the Sayyidatun Nisa, God made you the center of Kisa, by your name the sinners get Shifa. On that fearful day, to Allah we'll pray. Raise us with a Zahra, we shall say. On that fearful day, to Allah we'll pray. Raise us with a Zahra, we shall say.
Lady Fatima Zahra, Lady Fatima Zahra, Lady Fatima Zahra. welcome to Unscripted. I'm Kavit Akwai. Our guest joining us in this edition of the program is Daniel McAdams. He is the Executive Director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. Also co-host of the Ron Paul Liberty Report. He has served as Foreign Affairs Advisor to U.S. Congressman Ron Paul from the years 2001 until Dr. Paul's retirement at the end of 2012. From 1993 to 99, he worked as a journalist based in Budapest, Hungary, including as editorial page editor of the Budapest Sun, and he also served as a special rapporteur with British Helsinki Human Rights Group while based in Europe. And he joins us now for this edition of Unscripted. Daniel McAdams, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me on your show. I appreciate it.
It's great having you. I actually want to break the ice and get warmed up with this post that you had about this brilliant film that you said made by an Israeli Jewish filmmaker 26 years ago. The reason why I'm starting out with this is because what stood out in your description there, which you said was an integral part of my awakening on the Israeli issue. Maybe you could tell us in short what this film was all about and why you think it was important in your awakening on the Israeli issue.
Well, the film is, and I actually made a mistake in the initial post. It was, I think, 16 years ago, not 26 years ago. My math wasn't very good at the time I posted it. But it was, the filmmaker's name is Yoav Shamir. He's an Israeli filmmaker. He made that film. He also made Checkpoint and a few other films about the situation primarily in the West Bank, but certainly the situation among Palestinians. And what Defamation was about is the is the brainwashing of young Israelis from a very early age to the view that if they don't, you know, essentially destroy all of their enemies, another Holocaust will happen. And Yoav Shamir, in his brilliant way of making the film, Professor Finkelstein is in the film as well, but it really highlights how the Anti-Defamation League, the ADL in the United States, conspires to invent and create anti-Semitism where there really isn't any. And there are several scenes in the film where something very, very non-controversial is treated as an act of anti-Semitism. So it was an extremely well-done film, and it really moved me along in the process. Aren't always as they appear. That and Checkpoint, which is a great film that shows the horrible situation for West Bank residents when they want to go to the doctor and when they want to go to the store or anything, how they're treated like inhuman. And let's not forget, this is well over 10 years ago that he made this film. I'm absolutely certain it's much, much worse these days.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because I'm sure that then you must be shocked as to what's going on, not only in the Gaza Strip in terms of the genocide there, but also in terms of what's happening in the West Bank, which is, in essence, almost the same thing, but maybe it's in second gear at this point, moving on real fast in terms of displacement, in terms of all the different things that are happening, from human rights violations, etc. Does it surprise you when you see the genocide that has happened, in terms of the depth that Israel has stooped to basically carve up the land? We know in the West Bank they're very proud to say we're going to take over 82% and annex it.
Well, what surprises me even more than that, because we've seen a pattern for decades of Israel's behavior, but they'd always had some sort of a check on their bloodthirstiness, and now the check is gone. The reins are off. What really surprised me is to see a world stand by while a genocide is taking place right before their eyes, and many of these people saying never again, rightly so, to the genocide that was launched toward the Jews in Europe in the 1930s and 40s, and we're having the same situation right before our eyes. And unlike in those years, we can actually tune into X or any other network and see in real time the destruction, the maiming of children, the killing of, they say, upwards perhaps even of hundreds of thousands, multiple hundreds of thousands of innocent civilians being killed. And the world stands by and does nothing. And it's primarily because the United States stands by and does nothing and watches this happen. This will be a black stain on the United States and the American people for centuries to come.
Taking a look at now what the Israeli regime is doing, we understand it's continuing the genocide no matter what. And obviously, the U.S. has its back when it comes to the military support or the U.N. veto, as we just saw 24 hours ago. But we're also looking at an expansionist Israeli regime, where in West Asia, we call West Asia the Middle East, people know it as. and how it's going after other countries. And the attack on Qatar, I think, was a game changer in many different ways. We're looking at how the Israeli regime basically broke the regional taboos to hit a major non-NATO U.S. ally between Israel and Hamas. It's really incredible that they wanted to take out the host country that has the mediators there. What was your initial reaction on this? And do you think that that's a game changer? In what ways?
Well, not only that, it's such an act of treachery. And this is a pattern that Israel and the U.S. have done, which is to announce that you're going to have negotiations. And as soon as you gather the negotiators together, the Israelis, with the United States seal of approval, will kill those intermediaries, will kill those negotiators. It happened to Iran. We saw just before the sneak attack of Israel on Iran. It's happened in the past several times. It happened to Soleimani, who was getting ready to board a plane on a peace mission to negotiate peace when he was destroyed by Trump in the first administration. And now we see the same thing happening, attempted, same thing happening in Qatar. There have been other instances as well where you actually kill the negotiators who are trying to negotiate peace. That is a clear signal. It should be a clear signal to the rest of the world how Israel views peace negotiations. The way Israel views peace negotiations is how they behaved toward Lebanon and Syria. We do regime change. We decapitate your regime. We disarm you completely. And then the peace that you get is the peace that we impose on you. And so the lesson should be clear for Israel's Arab neighbors. And sadly, it doesn't seem to be getting through. But all you have to do is take a look at the map of Greater Israel, which they are not ashamed to show to anyone. They're not ashamed to hang it up behind them when they're speaking. They want a big chunk, not only of Saudi Arabia, but Iraq, of Turkey. And these countries still, they seem like it's, they don't view it as a serious threat. Well, I think with the one thing that Israel has shown in the last, since 2023 October, is that they're a threat to anyone, and they're not willing to back down. They will conquer every country in the region and subjugate it to Israel's will. So it's disheartening. You even have such a weak response from Qatar. Qatar is a major U.S. ally, the largest U.S. military base in the region. They clearly, unless the U.S. gave a green light, which probably is what happened. But then again, that speaks volumes as well. What a treacherous ally the U.S. is to green light an attack on a partner. So I would just say that the U.S. diplomacy has absolutely been destroyed by its absolute fealty, its absolute subservience to the state of Israel.
Well, I'd like to discuss that a little bit in detail in terms of the U.S. role here, because we know the U.S. President Donald Trump said that he was not aware that this was going to happen. And then he said, yes, we were given a heads up, but it was so late in the game that we didn't have a chance to really relay it in enough time for Qatar to react. But the skies over Doha, as far as we know, are monitored by Al Udeid, the largest U.S. military installation. We know that this is not a marginal outpost. It's the forward headquarters for the U.S. Central Command, U.S. CENTCOM. And in theory, anything entering Qatari airspace or nearby region without being detected by the IAMD, which is Integrated Air Missile Defense System, that provides air cover for the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council, which has Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and UAE, along with Jordan in it. There's no way that the U.S. would not have been aware of this Israeli intrusion into the Qatari airspace. So Trump's claim falls flat. Given that, are we looking at the fact that now the Persian Gulf Arab countries are definitely rethinking how the U.S. is claiming that it's the guarantor of their security, that that's just not going to happen in terms of how it suits the U.S.'s purpose?
Well, either the U.S. is completely incompetent and its weapons don't work to fulfill its obligations in the region to protect not only its own troops, of course, which is very important, but as you point out, its partners in the region. Either our weapons don't work very well or someone told them to stand down. Now, it may not have been the president. I think that's something that we have to consider, that there may be someone in control of this in his administration that is not him. He's not a detailed person. He doesn't like long briefings. He likes things very simplified. He may have just delegated this to someone, this whole operation to someone, and you know he can claim plausible deniability. Yeah, we knew about it, but it was late. Nobody's buying that. These things don't work that way. You don't just You don't just flip a switch on. They're as you point out, they're integrated. They're automatically integrated to protect our troops and our partners in the region, or they're not. So I would think that obviously they stood down because the U.S. seems to have this idea. I believe it takes its Arab partners for granted, and there is a precedent for it because they have shown a lack of willingness to stand up in the face of continued continued behavior by the U.S. in the region that shows that they're not viewed as an equal partner. But maybe this may be the issue. This may be something that brings them together. But I don't think we've seen a lot of evidence so far.
Yeah, it was very interesting when that summit happened, when you had Qatar invite, and in attendance were obviously the countries in the Persian Gulf, including not only Bahrain, the UAE, but also Iran attended. And at the end, the final communique was basically words of condemnation. Many were very disappointed in that. But then lo and behold, you had this Pakistan-Saudi Arabia defense pact, which was, that was quite an eye-opener. I'm wondering why Saudi Arabia chose Pakistan, because when you take a look at the fact that Pakistan is nuclear-armed, and then for the military agreement to happen, Mohammed bin Salman said that promises to boost defense cooperation and joint deterrence. Tell us your reaction to this joint pact, and how much of a possibility is there for other countries to join in?
Well, I think the prince was sending a very clear signal to the U.S., and it's probably the strongest and clearest signal that it can send to the U.S. I wonder about Pakistan's reliability, because the U.S. is always trying to infiltrate the Pakistani government. They've jailed Pakistan's independent-minded leaders in the name of Imran Khan and others. So the question is the reliability. But yes, definitely, there's no question about it. You're right. I mean, the juxtaposition of this conference in the Gulf and this agreement just a few days later sends a clear signal. And I think the signal is that that Saudi Arabia is ready to become a nuclear-armed country very quickly if this stuff keeps happening.
Why don't we take a look at the fact that you have the Iran coming into the picture after this attack by Qatar, and for the countries to basically reach the terms that Iran has been dealing with when it comes to Israel in terms of it attacking Iran, and Iran saying, see, I told you so, the U.S. cannot be a reliable partner. By default, obviously, the U.S. is behind Israeli moves in the region. Do you think we're looking at now a proactive move by countries in the region to align themselves in order to stand up against the U.S. and Israel? Because like you mentioned, Israel is on a war footing. It wants to expand itself, and other countries are in its firing line.
Well, the other thing to consider is that Israel is also in a race against time. Now, if you look at polling in the United States, support for Israel is at the lowest in its history. Megyn Kelly, who's a very famous U.S. journalist talk show host, said just a couple of days ago in a discussion she had with Tucker Carlson that if you look at the United States, literally everybody under 30 hates Israel. And that's a fact. And it's not just those on the left. It's young American conservatives in the 18 to 40 range who are, for the first time in my entire life, polling shows that the majority of them are opposed to our relationship to Israel. So Israel, I think, understands that it's a race against time. U.S. support right now can only be bought by our bought and paid for Congress and our bought and paid for administration. So they may believe that they have to go for broke now because this may be their last chance. Unfortunately, what that means is they have absolutely no compunction about killing every woman, child, baby, pregnant mother, even donkey in sight. They are going for broke on this, which is a bad situation. But they are also in a situation where they have no allies in the world, no allies in the entire world. And the only ally they have, the United States, is only an ally because the government is bought and paid for by AIPAC and other pro-Israel organizations. And don't forget the multi-billionaire Jewish, primarily Jewish, Americans who put Israel before their own country.
You know, I found it very interesting that just a few days back, you had the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, who came out, and it's one of those rare admissions where he said that, we are somewhat isolated. We have to deal with that fact. And he made a referral to how its economy is not doing well. And in particular, he talked about how Israel needs to be self-reliant when it comes to the arms industry. Because, for example, the UAE and some other countries have actually barred Israel from attending some of these arms expos. Now, when you have the Israeli Prime Minister say that, he says it with confidence as if nothing's going to deter Israel from, again, going on this war footing and expanding itself, which is going to involve more wars. Do you think that that's because it knows that the U.S. is actually going to be behind Israel all the way, and that is why the Prime Minister speaks with such confidence on the matter?
Well, that's one of the few times I would agree with Netanyahu. I mean, if that's your goal, go for it. You know, if your goal is to develop your arms industry independently, but that would also mean without the U.S. dollars, without U.S. technology, without U.S. support. If that's your goal, then I'm all for it, Bibi. Go for it. You know, but I don't think that's the case. I think it's, it wants the gravy train to continue. And don't forget, it's not just American tax dollars that are going for the Israeli military, but a lot of American tax dollars go into it's like a laundromat, a money laundering scheme, where they go into PR firms and think tanks in the Beltway that continue to push our relationships. So the American, poor American worker who's suffering with terrible inflation and a terrible economy is being robbed to pay to be propagandized in favor of being robbed to pay to being propagandized. It's a vicious circle, and the loser is always the American people and, of course, the people on the other end of Israeli bullets and bombs.
All right, let's move on to another topic, and that is one of the countries we mentioned somewhat, which is Iran. What has happened in the past day is the UN Security Council failing to adopt that draft resolution that basically enabled the snapback to officially now be activated. Now, you have to put things into perspective for us, which I'd like for you to do, but I'm looking at the context of Iran trusting the U.S., trusting its European allies. You're looking at five rounds of discussions that Iran had with the U.S., of which it then got bombed just a couple days later when they were supposed to have a meeting. And then you have the Europeans, where Iran talked with, made an agreement with the IAEA in Cairo, and yet you have, again, this snapback to come back into play. What reasons does Iran have, then, to actually continue this diplomacy that it's still open to do? But, you know, it keeps getting chipped away in terms of its confidence on having diplomacy with the Western nations.
Well, I'm not an expert on public opinion within Iran, but I would guess, if I could speculate, that the Iranian people are probably starting to get frustrated as well, maybe even with their leaders, that we keep trying to play by the rules and we keep getting kicked in the teeth. You know, at what point are we going to say enough? And I'm sure it's a pretty big discussion in Iran among the people, and I saw some things in Parliament where there was some anger and frustration about being willing to deal with the IAEA again after what many or most of us consider the treachery of revealing sensitive information that may have led to the murder of a lot of Iranian scientists. So, yes, they've played by the rules. My good friend Larry Johnson, who is a CIA officer and a great writer, he points out that he believes the Cairo agreement was a pretty clever idea on the part of Iran to appeal to its very legalistically minded friends in Russia and China and elsewhere. I believe also Pakistan and Algeria have also said that they will not follow along with the snapback sanctions. And I think that the Cairo agreement helped facilitate that, because Russia and China especially can point to it and say, look, they are doing everything they can to avoid this. They're doing everything they can. They're going to even let the inspectors back in, the people who they suspect of betraying them. They're willing to go this far, and still they get nothing for it. So that having been said, with the snapbacks going back into effect, at least from what I understand, maybe there's some new information, but that Iran has said that, well, the Cairo agreement is off, and if you're not going to consider this, then forget it. And if that is the case, it's probably a smart move the way they did it.
Well, that is something that's being discussed. They have not actually declared that to be null and void. They're looking also at another option, which they have discussed, but they haven't gone through yet, the official government line. And that is still being a member of the NPT. But do you think that these moves that are being initiated and now executed by the Europeans in terms of the snapback and by the U.S., whom doesn't seem to be interested in having any form of diplomatic talks at this point, is because that is what their intentions are, for Iran to want not to allow IAEA inspectors in the country, withdraw from the NPT to give them a reason, therefore, that, see, this is, as they would like to call it, a rogue nation, we need to attack it.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it. But, you know, the other issue is unrelated to Iran. Excuse me. Pardon me. And that is European frustration with Russia and China, particularly with regard to the Ukraine war. So in some ways, you know, Iran is in the middle, because the Europeans want to punish the Russians, certainly the Chinese, for continuing to do business with Iran, for ignoring the snapbacks, and Russia as well. So in a way, it's you know, it's Iran getting the short end of the stick, even though they agreed to some of these points with the Cairo agreement. The Europeans have nothing left. They've destroyed their economy, they've destroyed their credibility. You know, they're chasing shadows around, thinking that they're going to destroy Russia and overthrow Russia and invade Russia. So they're grasping at straws. They're desperate, and so I think that's one of the reasons that Iran is kind of a victim here, being caught in the middle of this European war against Russia.
I'm curious about the support of the U.S. I know we're back to that, even though we just covered that. You know, you had the words of Donald Trump that headlined in many periodicals online that said, Benjamin Netanyahu is me. Obviously, I'm not going to use the word. Okay, at the same time, we're seeing how Benjamin Netanyahu is being enabled by the U.S. It almost makes it sound like Trump saying that there's nothing I can do about that, but he realizes what the Israeli regime is doing. I mean, you know, Israeli regime, again, it's aside from the countries that it's targeting, it's also targeting the resistance groups in the region. And we're headed for some times here, like Lebanon, where God knows what's going to happen if this disarmament of Hezbollah is going to be, which is not going to go away, from the U.S.'s sites, including Israel. What do you think about Trump, first of all? Is he in the middle of not being able to do anything, even though he realizes that Israel is, through Netanyahu, doing whatever it wants?
I just don't buy it, you know, because we've seen this before. We've seen Trump express this frustration with Netanyahu before, and I think it's just for domestic consumption. You know, I'm very upset with Netanyahu, and then he holds out the chair for him, right? It was like a couple of days later. You know, this is PR stuff. If Trump were really felt that Netanyahu was giving him the what for, let's put it that way, then there are many moves that he could make. It's just like with everything else with Trump. It's just hollow air. It's hollow wind. There's no substance to anything that he says. So, I mean, I think the only interest Trump has in the whole region is the idea of developing the Gaza Strip into some sort of a big Trumpian paradise, you know, for his son-in-law to make more billions off of. And I say this as someone who wanted Trump to win. I do not have Trump derangement syndrome. I was happy that Trump won. I don't vote, so I didn't vote for him, but I was happy that he won. So I'd simply judge him on his actions as president. And between this and blowing up a bunch of ships, a bunch of little boats outside of Venezuela, and in constant bombing of Somalia and other places, the idea that he's the peace president is getting a little bit worn thin.
Well, he recently came out and made another revelation, of which he did talk about prior when he ran for presidency back in the year, I believe, 2020, and that's about trying to get back Bagram Air Base. I mean, let's spare thought here for Trump, who is supposed to be a peace president based on the platform he ran on. But as you said, he's bombing countries. He's launched deadly military strikes, civilian boats that you mentioned, preemptive military strikes on Iran. You have the bombing campaign in Yemen. Let's see, what else have we got? A desire to annex Canada, Greenland, Panama Canal, the Gaza Strip, and now directing Pentagon to target these drug cartels in Mexico as well. And now focusing on Afghanistan. I mean, did he put on a show, do you think, so he can pursue his goals now that he's reached power?
And don't forget his war on the American people, the war on the First Amendment here at home. If you happen to say something critical of Israel, you know, you're going to get nabbed. If you happen to be a foreign permanent resident, you're going to be sent back to where you came from. You know, so there's war on every single front. Even as he comically says that he's solved 7 wars, and it would have been 8 if he only would have been able to solve the Russia war, but he's still working on it. it's sort of a, it really is, you know, he's famous for being a reality TV star. This really is the reality TV show president, where every week there's a new chapter, there's a new episode that comes out with some new comical scheme that we can all laugh at and think, aha, that's crazy, that's funny. It just feels that way. It feels like we're all being gaslit by this administration. And I've never seen, my memory goes back to the Nixon administration even. I've never seen an administration this chock full of incompetence, of people who don't understand the basics of the American Constitution, for example. His attorney general saying that we don't have any right for hate speech and it'll be prosecuted, we're going to hunt you down. She doesn't understand the Constitution. It really is a government of the most incompetent people I've ever seen in my life.
Well, maybe there's a silver lining to all of this in terms of what's happening with other countries, in particular in the East. I don't know if you caught some of the scenes coming out of the SCO that was held in Tianjin in China. And basically, many headlines read Global Wealth and Power are pivoting to the East, China building its relationship with India in terms of the BRICS countries, surpassing the G7 in terms of their economic output. I don't know if you saw the scenes of almost a huddle between the Chinese president, the Indian president, and the Russian presidents. Of course, Iran is part of the SCO as well as a member. Are we really looking at this pivot to mark a new global order that surpasses the previous global order, but for it now to be perhaps more active in standing up to the U.S.?
It's amazing to see what's become of the SCO. I actually visited the headquarters in Shanghai back, I think, in 2006 when it was just getting started. And I was working for Dr. Paul at the time. We both had an inkling that this might turn out to be something significant, a different move for the rest of the world. And it obviously, this latest conference has shown, as you very well point out, has shown a serious, serious level of coordination and organization. The real tragedy here is that the U.S. should want to be part of this. These are countries that are investing in development in technologies that we don't even have in the U.S. We spend at least $1.5 trillion a year on our military, on protecting our overseas empire, while Americans are struggling to survive in an economy that's terrible with inflation out of control. We should want to be part of this. That's the ethos of America, doing business overseas, trading. It could be enormously profitable for the United States. But unfortunately, we're governed by a bunch of knuckleheads who only know how to enrich the military-industrial complex to the detriment of every one of the rest of us.
All right, and my final question to you, since we have run out of time, unfortunately, I had so much more to cover with you, is the fact that we are still looking at many who are interpreting this ceasefire between Israel and Iran to be temporary, that Israel is going to attack Iran again. Israel just boasted about their laser beam, defense shield that acts like a defense shield for any incoming missiles. Iran just tested its own Khorramshahr, which is said to be able to penetrate, obviously, the Israeli airspace and hit its target with pinpoint accuracy. It did so on many occasions in the 12-day war. If there was a war to be ignited, what type of outcome? I know this is just speculation, but what type of outcome do you foresee happening here?
Well, first of all, no one wants it to happen. Or certainly I don't, and you don't. No one in Iran wants it to happen. Most people in the United States do not want it to happen. But I don't think the Israelis can – they don't have an off switch right now. They are fired up, and they're ready to destroy all of the people they consider to be their enemies. So I think there's a very, very high chance of Israel doing it again. And they're going to want to – and I hope I'm wrong. For God's sake, I hope I'm wrong. They're going to want to do it as they see support for Israel flagging in the United States, as I said earlier. They're going to want to do it sooner rather than later. I hope it doesn't happen. But certainly, I mean, if I were in charge of Iran, I would never let my guard down. And I think even the head of the Mossad said the other day, we have even more treachery planned, even more secret, nasty things that we have planned for Iran.